Weekend Breakfast with Refil Mpakanyane on 702 for the curious.
And if you've just joined us, you are just in time to dip into Tim Neary's Nature Diary as we look at various aspects of conservation and sustainability. Good morning, Tim Neary.
Good morning. Now, that's a nice way of bringing it in, conservation and sustainability. I like that.
Absolutely, because that's ultimately what we want, don't we? We want to make sure that the flora and the fauna, which we'll be talking about just now, that we currently have, remains viable for the long term.
You know, I think there's something that we've also got to really get our head around is that no matter that we want the fauna and flora to remain viable, and remember that if we remove this bipedal human from it, then we definitely don't have a problem. And I think the more that we get into it nowadays, we discover that conservation is really about conservation of mankind.
Sure, and we can also lump ourselves into that group of fauna as well. And then it takes away this sort of internal pyramid that we've established.
It does. It takes away this whole thing about, you know, that conservation is for rich white folk or rich folk of any color. But it's for rich people, and conservation isn't for the average man in the street. And that's what we've got to get our head around. We've really got to understand that it's how does man survive with the planet?
Yeah.
The planet, that's why I love it when man turns around and says, hang on a minute, we're saving the planet. Really?
From who?
Okay, we'll jump off then.
So, Tim, I guess any conversation at this point since lockdown needs to begin with the state of the garden. What's happening out there in your office?
In my office, I'm looking out into this last couple of days. We've had these lovely warmish daytimes, so the flowers have all come out. There've been a lot of new insects in the garden over the last couple of days. Obviously, I think we're about 4 degrees at the moment, so we've gone away from those negatives coming out and sitting outside here. Negatives.
Yes, absolutely.
And then testing a, I sent Comfort a picture of it, testing a milk bottle bird feeder, which took a bit of time because it's white, and I think it's just too stark in color, so the birds were a bit wary of it. You can always spray them green if you want to, but it's one of those square milk bottles.
Yes, yes, yes.
And it's quite nice because you just to make it, just a quick way is in the cap, drill a small hole in the top of the cap, put a piece of string through, tie a knot. Now it'll hang very nice and level. For the seating arrangement for anybody who wants to sit down to breakfast, just push in a couple of meat skewers, Society sticks.
Sure.
Poke them through, that's done, and then you just cut little slots in the bottle, about 10 down to 10 millimeters or so from the actual meat stick so the little bird can get his head inside. And this is, it took about 3 days, and now everybody's in it.
Okay, they're finally used to it.
Yeah, what you got to love is you always get some bird who's got the bright idea. He gets inside the feeder and commands it from there and chases everybody else away. So, yeah, it's a lot of fun.
Oh, I love it. And I have to admit, when Comfort sent me your write-up and your blurb, and it says, Tim's tip on how to make El Cheapo bird feeders. And I have to admit, for a moment there, I read it as El Chapo. And I thought, my goodness, when in the world did the South American drug dealer get into making bird feeders? But no, it's not El Chapo bird feeders. It is El Cheapo bird feeders from 2 liter milk bottles. All right, let's get into it, Tim, which is the world of reptiles and concerns on poaching for expert or and just also talking about the trade, rather, of fauna and flora. Talk to me about what's currently happening. We know that there is a regime that was established many, many decades ago, the Convention on International Trade in Endangered Species of Wildlife and Flora. But the state of that compact is what?
Yeah, well, there we got the good one. So for folk to understand that you've got CITES, which I always spell as cities by mistake,
yeah.
But never mind that. But you have CITES, which, you know, somebody will say that is protected under CITES. No, it's not. CITES is really just an area of agreement. It's a bunch of folk that sit in an office, and they look at the trade of endangered species.
Mm-hmm.
So they have absolutely no muscle whatsoever. And they will turn around and say that rhino are endangered because there's a certain number. The scientists have told them so, and therefore we should ban the trade. Now, it's an advisory body. That's okay. Really, it's supposed to work on the form of cooperation.
Okay.
And if you can get your head around that, and the various levels are usually, I think there are 5 levels of anything that, whether it is threatened, near threatened, endangered, critically endangered, or extinct.
So when we use phrases like that, it's because CITES has applied those labels and disseminated that information to the rest of the
correct.
World.
Okay. And you've got to also remember that when somebody says something is extinct, birds, for example, they usually work upon the principle of there are less than 50 breeding pairs in the wild.
Okay.
And then if something is classed as extinct, it may be extinct in an area and not necessarily extinct on a continent or in a country. Mm-hmm. So it could be extinct to Johannesburg, but could be doing really well down in Vereeniging.
Okay.
Right. So that now we've got that little lot. And what I found rather interesting is if we break the poaching trade down, there's 3 areas really that trade happens in the world of poaching.
Mm-hmm.
That is food, medicinal trade, and then beauty and collectors.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And we kind of forget that, you know. Mm-hmm. And because some animals are charismatic, we understand that poaching on an elephant because it's shot, it's a huge animal, you can see it, rhino, etc. We get all that. We get the lions. But what about the rest of the guys? You know, and we spoke about the most traded animal is the pangolin, as we've been talking about.
Mm-hmm. And of course, now, the pangolin at least ticked 2 of those boxes, right? Food and medicinal trade. And
yep,
that's why it's so highly poached.
Correct. It ticks 2 boxes.
Mm.
It's very seldom that something will tick 3 boxes. And now we can start to go all the way down and think, hang on a minute, why is the poor old penguin in trouble? Well, the penguin ticked not only the word of food, but the penguin also ticked the box of fuel. So
okay.
The poor old penguin was used at the whaling stations because they're lovely little fat things. So they were used as fuel at the whaling station. You lit the fire under the whaling pots and then kept on tossing in a few penguins from time to time to keep the fire going.
Mm.
And then penguin eggs were the bigger demise of the penguins than anything else, because penguin eggs were sought after. They were sought after in sort of upper-class restaurants across the world, etc. So tens of millions of penguin eggs were removed and sent out. Keep on going. Beetles, lizards, skinks, various reptiles, snakes.
Sure.
Very few of the snakes are taken, and I'm going to hopefully get Johan Marais in a couple of weeks to come and chat to us about it.
Yeah.
Very few snakes go out for the food trade, but they usually go out for the beauty trade, the collectors. And I mean, it is absolutely frightening. Birds' eggs. And then, of course, when you think that you just finished there, then we start on plants. And most of if people knew how many of their plants in their garden started out in a poached manner, they'd most of not want them. You know, so we've got lots of plants that are poached. And again, plants are poached predominantly for medicinal value.
Mm-hmm.
But then we move on to that wonderful thing, the beauty, where people poach cycads, etc. And that's just to have them. You know, it's like a piece of, like a work of art that's been stolen.
Yeah.
You own it, you've got it, you've locked it away, and you can't tell anybody about it.
I was about to ask you to just help me understand, and let's talk about, let's focus on cycads and stay with them for a moment. So you've gotten your hands on the cycad illegally, and then what? Or are you so brazen that you actually aren't hiding it, at least from your associates and intimate circles and friends and family, and they lovingly come through and gaze upon the cycad and say, good boy, good job, Johnny. Good one with the cycad. What is the psychology behind the beauty aspect of collecting things that are illegally procured? Clearly, it's a societal. Is it a societal acceptance of this such behavior?
Please lie down on the couch and talk to me. I'll be your psychologist for this one.
Please.
I don't know, you know, and I think what happens is it becomes, I suppose, a cult, a brotherhood, or whatever you would want to speak to about it, because these things then become traded amongst other people own them and can't show them to anybody.
Mm.
So years ago, I worked within the Endangered Species Protection Unit. And you were guaranteed that if you went to somewhere who had cycads that had been stolen out the wild and planted in their garden, the first thing you were confronted with was a very large wall when you arrived at the
sure,
house.
Sure, of course.
So nobody could see in.
Yeah.
And it's quite strange. It's sometimes the, shall we say, the everyday Joe Sixpack and family, sometimes you get one or two folk there who are collectors of items that they shouldn't have. But predominantly, it's big money. Mm. And I think, you know, that's where we also got to understand. This whole world of poaching is big money. And therefore, even the pangolin, when we say that China has said no more trade in pangolin or, you know, no more trade in elephant ivory, etc. Okay, right, where to from here? Because the poacher doesn't understand that. It's so so installed into the whole syndicate culture, etc. That it just doesn't end.
Mm.
And, you know, don't only think that things that are poached are the new live modern things. Let's start getting into things in paleontology. What about fossils? Fossils are traded.
Yeah.
We've got the fact that they actually mine the woolly mammoth tusks because that was the only ivory allowed into America.
Sure.
So, you know, hello, man is a strange creature. We don't understand. We don't understand when it gets to the end either.
Mm.
And we just keep on pushing it. And then as, of course, it starts to become threatened, then it seems to be that the poaching accelerates because now you want to do the very last one.
Well, it's an arms race now, so you can be one of only few to have
a limited
material or resource. So, Tim, just the logistics of I've always been intrigued when you're watching sort of those trashy airport reality TV shows where they catch people trying to get into a country with a parrot wrapped in a T-shirt stuffed into a toilet paper roll or bizarre things like that. But the logistics of trafficking these flora and fauna, in fact, and the success rate, essentially, because is the bulk of the damage, in fact, even done in the moving and the transporting of these? And is this where they're lost as well, leading to an even greater demand for more?
Very much so, very much so. And I think we always, you know, when we laud the fact that somebody, for example, has found X number of rhino horn, understand that the poachers have got to go and restock that because they need to fill the order.
Mm.
And I often wonder how many of the things that are found at places like the airports and what have you, how many of those things are put there to let the authorities catch something and then be really happy about
it. As a decoy.
While everything is moving out.
Mm.
Now, we stopped many, many years ago. There was an article done on an aircraft flying from, I think it was the Congo, down to South Africa. And it was at Lanseria Airport. And it was found that they had brought in a whole pile of parrots. And all they did was they put a double floor on the bottom of the aircraft. Each parrot was bound with insulation tape and packed in like little sausages into the aircraft. If they got 20% of the parrots back to South Africa alive, they had made their money.
Sure.
So I think on that occasion it was over 100 parrots that were found in the aircraft. And if I remember rightly, most of them were dead.
Mm-hmm.
So that is another issue. That is another traded issue. And, you know, it's where people don't realize it. It's if you've got a marine fish tank, for example, the level of poaching for the little tropical, the subtropical fish that you get off Durban, Mozambique, they are really valuable. So there's a lot of them moved, stuck into the cars and brought up to Joburg.
Mm-hmm.
And everybody turns around and says, but I'm only taking one for my fish tank. Yes, but there are 1,000 of you taking one for your fish tank.
Absolutely.
It starts to mount up.
Yeah.
And of course, we do question what our minister is doing at the moment when we're starting to declare a lot of CITES species. We're starting to declare them normal farm animals in South Africa.
Mm-hmm.
So now we can breed wild dogs and all sorts of creatures. And then does it mean that we can trade them because they are now classed as domestic livestock? So, you know, is that a way that we're now trying to get around it? Of course, they are being very, very cagey when it comes to trying to get an answer.
Mm, and answering those questions. And back to CITES, Tim, obviously we've gone into the area of illegal poaching and illegal trading of these flora and fauna. But does CITES look at and cover areas of of legal, you know, trading and trading and buying of these. And I immediately, my mind jumps to, for instance, overfishing and international agreements of who can fish in which waters. But inevitably, it always boils down to, you know, almost a, an honesty sort of agreement where you have to rely on countries to, in many ways, self-regulate. Or is there an effective and active body, regulatory body, that takes care and keeps on top of overfishing?
I've never, ever seen a court case with overfishing that has been successful.
Mm.
So it's a case of, it should be an honesty base, but it's not. So if you go and look at Mozambique, for example, Mozambique is continuously raided by the Chinese trawlers.
Mm.
The Chinese, the Taiwanese, etc., the trawlers that come, when they come close inshore, right into the breeding grounds, they have no regard for that. All they're trying to do is the food. So, you know, now we have that as an issue. And those large nets that they drag across, which are completely destructive to the bottom of the ocean.
Sure.
No. And, you know, we don't even have a reasonable gunboat that can go along and chase anybody out. So consequently, it's a hide-and-seek game. And no, there's nobody that, you know, will really go along and say, you have done this, we're locking your country up, we're locking your fishing up, we're fining you $100 billion, etc., so that we can repatriate or whatever we want to do.
Mm.
And no, I don't see that happening at all,
yeah.
Which is rather sad. So the honesty basis is there. Countries love to tell us where their international borders are, but I think they mean deadly squat.
Yeah. So before, as we wrap up with CITES, so we know that that was drafted as a result of a resolution adopted in 1963 at a meeting of members of the International Union for Conservation of Nature, right? And then it was opened for signature in 1973, entered into force on the 1st of July in 1975. Have there been any groundbreaking, useful, progressive amendments to CITES since then? I guess in many ways I'm asking, Is it currently still fit for purpose?
I think it's fit for purpose from the point of view of a guideline.
Okay.
But if only it was had some form of international clout where it could actually turn around and, for example, the International Court of The Hague, if only we could have something to that effect. But what would it achieve?
Mm.
And I guess that's the big issue around it. And you know, it's a case of this ever-increasing farm animal called man. It's the only species that I know of that we don't regulate according to its available food supply. Nasty, isn't it?
I'm waiting. Yeah.
You've got to deal with the calls after this one, not me.
I will send out your email address then, JP, directly.
But it is true. Think of it. Think of a farm. Think of the farm. You can only have so many animals. Think of how things self-regulate, and we don't self. We really are very hard on it, and I think it's something we've got to understand. We can't keep on taking without giving back.
All right. Well, I'll build up the stamina for that debate and that argument. But for now, I've got a question from Jenny who wants to know, the birds at my house don't want to eat rye bread. Why? And any advice?
Jenny, I think the issue really is that because when you go to the shopping center, I'm yet to see a bird walking in with its purse to buy some rye bread. Birds really, if you try and toast it and then crumble that toast, they might snack on that. But the problem is that we have is that so many of our breads have got preservatives in them. And the little bird can't, they've got very small digestive systems. They're very quick digestive systems. Think, what a bird's eating in one end, it's pushing out the other. So when we've got that, we can't really, the bird doesn't assimilate it nicely. Give it bird seed. Give it a few things that it likes, bits of fruit, etc. Make some of those suet balls, those homemade suet balls that really work well. It's a bit of suet. It's a bit of mealy meal. A little bit of peanut butter. Just make sure that it doesn't have any of the artificial sweeteners in it, because that, again, is not good for them. Mm-hmm. Mix it up. Let it dry in the sunshine. Make it into balls in your hand, and then pop it on a bird feeder. Your birds will be much happier.
All right, there you go. I guess the answer's right there. They're not happy with it. So lovely advice there. Let's take a look at a book that you have, that you read, I guess, The Night Skies of Botswana. I love it when you bring these guides into studio. I think that's the one part I miss of being able to do things in real life. Tell me about The Night Skies of Botswana, this guide to star watching.
Never mind, we'll get back to that real life. Night Skies of Botswana, Stephen O'Meara, it is a straight nature book.
Mm.
It's really nice. But think of Botswana. We've got no light pollution. You can lie back to the point that the stars burn your eyes. And you then want to know who is where. So often we know exactly where we can look up to see Orion's Belt or Scorpio or Cancer or whoever we want to look at in the sky.
Mm-hmm.
But we don't know where they are in Botswana. So this gives you a item of what you need to start stargazing, which could be a simple pair of binoculars to the really expensive stuff. It tells you where to look in the sky. There are nice apps that you can use in conjunction with it as well to find the different stars. But it tells you all about the stars. It tells you where to look at them. By the month, who should be really shining and where, what position they are.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just one of those really nice ones. It's not something you're going to sit and read out completely. But
sure.
It does cover interesting things like why do we have a daylight moon, for example. You know, that sort of idea. So there's a great amount inside here. Discuss some all essential stargazers tools, tips before mapping the southern skies in a series of monthly star charts. All these sort of things are in there. And there are a lot more people than we realize that, no, we're not sailing ancient ships with Tagama using the stars to navigate.
Mm.
But there are a lot of people that have got that interest in the stars. And kids have an incredible interest in the stars.
Yeah.
You know, and then you can start to appreciate. So it's success. It's designed for the fledgling as well as the experienced stargazers, which I kind of like. It really is for everybody. But, yeah, it's a nice book if you're going to Botswana or you want to know more about the Botswanan skies. And it covers it, as I said, by month, which is really nice. The western sky at a glance in February, the northern sky, and therefore you can start to see everybody.
Yeah, and just prime yourself for when travel is finally feasible or eventually feasible, something to look forward to. I got to say, I think I remember being a kid and for the very, very first time, as you talk about in appreciating the night skies and being able to see so much of the stars with the naked eye, we'd gone on a family trip to the Drakensberg and my little toddler mind was absolutely, I was older than a toddler, but was absolutely blown. And it's the most beautiful thing that I think if you are a city person or a city bound person, you don't understand the beauty the beauty that you're missing out on until it finally happens.
Well, it is, you know, and I think you get what we call that big sky when you're in places like Botswana, down in the Karoo. Just as long as you can get out of the city where you don't have trees clustering over you and you don't have all that light pollution. And you really realize, you know, when somebody looks up and says, well, I don't see any stars in Joburg. Well, you really realize the reflected light pollution that we have. And then you go out to somewhere, the Kalahari, the Karoo, even in the Vaal Dam, and you go and lie on the back, on your back on a boat in the middle of the Vaal Dam and look up. And the sky is that incredible crispness.
Mm-hmm.
And, of course, our wintertime skies in places like Swalu, etc., up in the Kalahari, they are awesome now.
Yeah.
It's so bright, and you look up, and it's just that Milky Way. Find me the Milky Way in Joburg. We can't. Go out of town and you lie there and look at it. And as you say, it's just this road in the sky of absolute beauty.
Tamiri, thanks so much. A pleasure. You and I will touch base again next Sunday. Thank you so much for
next
this
Sunday,
lovely chat.
Next Sunday, we will have a guest as well.
All right. You keep well until then.